Yes, this gentleman said, right, I'll buy this. I was then in the position that I'd sold 1.5 million shares, which I didn't actually have permission to sell. We wanted to buy them anyway. And I think the problem being that my phraseology hadn't been correct. Anyway, I was then forced to go back to the firm and say, well, we had a slight sort of botch here. I've sold that 1.5 million, and I'm not sure whether I can get any of them back or anything. And it was a frightful row about it, and eventually I was able to get Wed to compromise a little bit. But I mean, that was the first real nightmare that I think I had, when I suddenly found I'd sold all these shares without, I hadn't really got the selling order anyway.
Yes. What was involved in getting them to compromise? Did you go back to them and talk to them on the pitch? Or?
Yes, well, in fact, I think we got their partner dealer to come out to the box, and, you know, I had to confess that I'd made a complete cock of it. Mm. That, you know, was there any way you could sort of salvage a little bit of my future? And, I mean, as in all these cases, I think that there was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek when he bought the stock in the first place, just to slightly teach me a lesson. And I think we compromised, and he probably took $250,000 and we took 1.25 back. But it was quite a good lesson, because, you know, you can get very casual about how you actually approach a deal. Mm. And this was a good lesson early on in one's career, that you want to actually get it right first time.
Did you feel that one had to develop a technique in dealing with a jobber? One had to be careful about what one said. And
again, depending who you were talking to. I mean, if one was talking to one's own age group, who one had grown up with, that was fine. But if you were talking to the senior partners, who you would actually be talking to in a situation where you have a rump or something like that, then you did have to be extremely careful, because they were obviously miles more senior than you. And so you were slightly slightly at their mercy. And so you did actually have to work out very carefully what you were going to say, that they couldn't nip in and sort of put a spanner in the works. Mm.
When did you start doing the bigger business?
I would think in about, I think 63, 4, when probably started.
Mm. And what kind of business was that? Was that institutional business?
It was purely
business?
Institutional. Business and new issue business.
And again, was that across the range of UK equities?
Yeah.
Now, again, with that kind of business, did you only check your price with particular jobbers, or did you feel that one had to go and check with virtually all the jobbers in that particular market?
In straightforward institutional business, which in the early 60s wasn't sort of, I mean, it's nothing like the size that people talk about nowadays. You probably checked it in, I mean, there was normally one or two jobbers who were on an even keel as being good in a particular stock. So you would probably reckon to end up with one of them. I think that in ordinary, straightforward institutional business, you would check it in one, maybe two places. But you would probably end up in the, if everything went according to plan and they made the same price, or you would probably go to the one you were hoping to deal with last. Mm. And, you know, if you were lucky, you got the same price or a better price from him. Mm. If not, you just had to turn around and, you know, go behind a pillar and go back to whoever was making the best price.
Was that something you had to be careful about, offending jobbers because you're not...
No, I think that the jobbers knew jolly well that the situation can change from minute to minute, and if one guy suddenly has done a big bargain, he's going to make a different price. Mm. So, and it could go to any of them. Mm. So I think the brokers felt more embarrassed than the jobbers about having to, you know, trying to deal with someone and then finding that he was not making the right price. Mm. In the new issue business or in the takeover business, then I think one generally selected In a new issue, you would get all the dealers who dealt in that particular issue. You'd get them all into the box, and you would deal with them all. I mean, you give the bigger, better dealers more stock or than the little ones, but you would get them all in together. In takeover or building a stake or anything like that, then I think you would select your jobber without checking. I mean, you in something like that, you probably had a day or two's notice that there was possibly a deal coming along. In which case, you would be keeping an eye open by looking at prices on boards, and you might talk to one chap occasionally, just see if there was anything going on in that stock. But you would probably have made up your mind who you were going to deal with by the time you got the order. And then you would get him out to the box, and you would tell him as much or as little as you wanted to tell them.
And would you then be in a situation where you'd be leaving a limit with the jobber, who would then accumulate stock and pass it on to you or sell it on to you?
Yes, in the early days, yes. I don't think that's... I think that's against the rules now, but certainly in the 60s or early 70s, yes, you would get him, take him into the box or take him out for a drink or something, and you would say, look, we want to buy a lot of these, or want to either give him the amount or say, you know, give him half the amount or whatever, depending how big, and say, you know, we'll give X. Would you like to accumulate them and you know, let me know when you sell me a quarter of a million, or sell me units of a quarter of a million when you've got enough? And you know, you could do it that way, or I mean, if you're building a stake, there's not much point in booking 5,000 shares 20 times a day or something, and so he would accumulate it and then come and offer you a reasonable amount. And if he couldn't deal at the price that you had said that you could deal at, you know, he'd say, I can't sell them to you at 200p or £2 or whatever. You can have them at 205. Well, then you'd go back and decide whether you want to give 205 for them.
And was secrecy generally, or security, generally well maintained, in the sense that...
It should be. Security is one of the hardest things to maintain, because there were various brokers who might be doing this sort of thing, probably the bigger ones, so you were always being watched by other people in the market. Dealers were always, you know, if there seemed to be a buyer always for this particular stock, dealers would find out in other firms, and rumors would get around. Your own firm, your salesman might be talking to the clients and say, well, you know, if you ever wanted to sell any of XYZ, you know, do let us know. You then find that client is talking, you know, at lunchtime is talking to someone and say, oh, by the way, you know, I think there's a buyer for these. It's terribly difficult to keep things secure. I mean, some people were better than others, but
would happen when the news did get out?
Normally, other people would come in and buy the shares, which put them up, which meant that you couldn't buy any more.
Mm. Was the firm involved in any of the big contested takeovers of the 60s?
I'm trying to think of. Can you give me an example?
Well, GEC and AEI.
No.
ICI and Courtaulds.
We were involved in that, which we failed in, yeah. so that wasn't much good.
What happens what then? You're unable to build a stake.
Yes, there were other reasons there for ICI and Courtaulds, weren't there? I'm trying to think that either the city generally thought it was a bad idea or... I think the defence was too good for us.
So then one simply unravels the
Yeah, but there wasn't a great deal of state building, I don't think, in those days. You know, you made a bid and you either got it or you didn't. Mm-hmm. I think state building only came in the 70s, late 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. Just to revert to the rights issues for a moment, would the jobbers be important to you in deciding the terms of an issue?
Not particularly, no. I mean, what is important is the price of the shares, mm-hmm. Which, yeah, the jobber decides what the price is, but he's not really influential. I mean, one would probably talk to the chairman and he would tell you that there's not much going on in the stock, or they are quite a good market and there are buyers about, which might influence you a little bit. But basically, it's you judge what the rights issue is going to be on the price of the shares. And, you know, you get asked a job if he can hold the price at a certain level, which is actually a pointless operation, because normally when you're told to do that, the new issue department say, well, we haven't got any money to buy any shares of that level. So no job is going to hold a price, you know, unless you can pass the stock on. They're useful purely in the general information about that stock at that time and what's going on in it, but I don't think they would be consulted, and, you know, there's a rights issue coming, because I think that would be the last thing you would actually try and tell them. They might find out, but you know, if there is a rights issue, their first reaction is probably to mark the shares down.
Were jobbers important in underwriting?
They were very useful. Mm-hmm. Because the big jobbers took quite substantial amounts of stock. Mm-hmm. They in the early days they never got enough, and probably in the later in the 70s and early 80s they didn't. Since the I think 84 onwards, with one or two sticks and bad sort of issues, they've become much more discerning. And I think now under the new regime, they quite often turn it down. Well, that would have been unheard of in the old days of jobbing. They would always take the stock, even if they knew or feared that it was going to be a bum one.
When did, let me rephrase that. Were put-throughs an important part of one's activities?
Yes. I think this varied from firm to firm, and perhaps due to the amount of sales, institutional sales men that each firm employed. We were looked upon as one of the worst, or one of the firms most likely to do put-through business. We crossed a great deal of our business. That one could understand the jobber's irritation at this, because it's much nicer for them to get a clean deal and they'd be able to make a bit more perhaps out of it. We'd always done it, and through the 70s, when we had the slump in the 72, 3, 4, and then there was another bad period in the 77, I think, 77, 8, it became essential, really, to try and cross as much business as we could so we could get two commissions to at least cover costs if possible. So we did an awful lot of put through business. There was Rule 90 put through.
Yes. Now, could you describe to me, in your words, what Rule 90 entailed?
Well, it had possibly different meaning to lots of different people. I felt the Rule 90, and my jobbing friends mightn't agree that we were very good at following my interpretation, but I maintain that we always did. I believe that Rule 90 meant that if you had a line of stock to sell, before you were able to mention it to any of your clients as that you were a seller of this, might you be interested in buying it, that you had to go to one jobber who should be one of the leading jobbers in that stock and clear a put through with him, i.e. say, look, I'm a seller of X, I'd like to try and make a buyer of them. I think the level we should do it is at 195 to a half. Would you have any objections and would you want any stock? And the jobber might say, yes, I'd like all the stock, or he might say, like 100,000 of it. And we would then try and maybe cut him down and say, well, you don't really want 100, wouldn't 50,000 do, if I knew that we were almost certain to be able to make buyers. And you would come to a compromise. Now, where it went wrong quite often was that some salesmen thought that if you cleared a put through and you tried all your buyers and none of them wanted it, that you could then go back to the jobber and say, well, I'm sorry, we failed, you've got them all. Which, in my view, was plainly unfair, because you'd then covered all the likely buyers. You couldn't expect the jobber to be on. There might be a case where he would say, well, you know, while you're trying, I will actually leave you a firm bid of 190, slightly lower, for the lot, whether you succeed or fail. Or he might say, well, I know I've got a buyer of 100,000, he's left it firm with me, so I've got to stuff him, which we couldn't argue with. But what would then possibly have happened is that one of our salesmen would have jumped the gun before we've cleared the put through and gone on to his client and said, look, we're about to be a seller of this. Might you be interested? And the chap says, I would be very interested. I'm a buyer through another chap. Give me a minute and I'll get off from the other broker and then I'll take your stock. The jobber's bought his 100 because he's got a firm buyer in the book. He goes along to the broker who says, oh, funny you're coming to see me. I'm just coming to tell you I'm no longer firm in buying that stock. I just had the order cancelled. Mm-hmm. The job is stuffed. Mm-hmm. His buyer is reneging. He's going to come through us. I mean, it shouldn't have happened in the first place because our salesman shouldn't have talked to the client. Now, this did happen, undoubtedly, much more often than it should have done. And we dealers down on the floor would always implore the salesman not to talk to anybody until we had cleared it. And I should think 9 times out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, the salesman would go on and say, well, you know, we're about to get a seller, I think, of these. And then you'd go back and say, you know, you haven't told anyone, have you? No. But I mean, you don't need to say we're sellers of 500,000 at X. All you got to do is say, look, hang on, I think we got a seller. I'll be in touch in a few minutes. And you've ruined the market for anyone else. And this is where it caused the most tremendous amount of aggro, and quite understandably. But it Rule 90, I think, was always the bugbear of jobbers and brokers.
Well, were there ever situations where the jobber himself, you having opened the jobber in a sense, the jobber then knowing that there might be a big buyer or a seller about, in fact goes and spoils the broker's market?
No, I don't think the jobber that you've cleared your put through with, or that you've talked to, I don't think he would ever do it. There might be another jobber who gets a sniff of the order through a client talking to a broker and saying, we've just been offered a line of this. It could come round the back through another broker back to a different jobber who might then, knock the shares down a bit because he doesn't want to be stuffed. And there's no doubt that this used to happen, that if the market price was 200 to 3 and we were doing a put through at 90 to a half or something like that, that there would be one or two spivs who would see the stock from us, would be offered it, they'd buy it. and they'd actually be sending another broker in to sell stock against it, so that they'd take a straight 10p out of the market. So, I mean, another jobber might spoil the market or market price down, but I mean, the clients actually were pretty naughty, and I think brokers were slow to realise quite how naughty some of them were.
Did you feel your clients had a good grasp of the way the stock exchange worked and the way one might be able to use different brokers to serve their own interests or to make a bit of extra money?
I think in the old days, they did. I think the clients had an understanding of the broking and the jobbing world, and they felt that they got a reasonable deal out of life, and they were happy to let it go like that. I think what went wrong, or not what altered the situation, was that you started getting performance funds and terrific competition between fund managers, and you got these chaps if they could make 10p on 25,000 shares very quickly, albeit that it wasn't actually playing by the rules or straight. It was more important to them to make 10p on 25,000 shares than they could go to their boss and say, look, our performance fund's looking good today. And that, I think, is what probably caused the problems.
Did you feel the jobbers appreciated the kind of pressures that you, the brokers, were under from your bigger clients?
I think that they this is getting much later, in the 70s, 80s. I think they could understand that, but I think they were much more concerned at the pressures that they were under, which I think were pretty considerable, because they were being invited to deal in larger and larger amounts, go on bigger and bigger risk, were being slightly carved up at every point along the track, either by the customers or perhaps by one or two brokers. They were seeing very little clean business, which is the business that you actually would, you've got a chance of making money on. There was more and more of this put-through stuff going on. I mean, they were under quite considerable pressure. There, they were probably making good money. Despite
just,
it.
Just to revert to the put-through for a moment, if one's managed to match a buyer and seller, and the jobber hasn't wanted to take any of the stock, what's the final step in completing a put-through? Do you go back to the jobber and put the bargain through him?
Yeah, you've agreed with him that you can go and place the stock at 195 or 5 to 1/2. You do it. What you would normally do, depending how big it is, if it's very big, you would probably go back to him in 10 minutes after you've cleared and say, look, he's going quite well and we should be able to let you know in another 5 minutes whether it's all done. Or you go back and say, look, we're struggling a bit. But it might come all right. As soon as it's done, you would then go back and say, right, that's fine, we've done it. Can I sell you X at 195 and buy back X at 195.5? And they say, fine, and that's it. But you certainly would keep them in touch as it was going along. If it was a vast amount of shares and it was obviously going to take some time to do, then you would just keep them in touch.
Yes. At some stage, jobbers decided they were going to take a minimum turn on a put-through.
Yeah.
What was the broker's feeling towards that?
That was, my own feeling was that was it was useful. I mean, what it amounted to was half our commission, I think. And that was a nice, easy benchmark to go on, and everybody agreed it, and so there were no discussions. Until that had come in, you'd negotiate, and I think a halfpenny is right, and they say no, they think twopence is right, and it was you never felt quite that, you know, everybody was happy. Either the broker felt he'd given too much or the jobber felt he hadn't got enough. Once this guideline of half a one commission, then, you know, you couldn't, there wasn't an argument or discussion. Everybody would appear to be happy.
What was your feeling towards minimum spreads generally? I don't know when they first started to
I think that is appear. What first began to bring a little bit of conflict between brokers and jobbers in, when they started having price agreements, spread agreements. Because, I mean, it was all due to competition, you know, some jobbers were carving up or whatever. But, I mean, that really is actually what the stock exchange was. It's free enterprise and competition was what it was meant to be. The moment you start bringing in price spread agreements, and these ones are going to be a threatening spread, and sorry, I'd love to make you a different price, but can't. Or, indeed, some saying, well, we've got to make a threatening spread, but actually, you can have them a penny cheaper or something. I mean, it just, it was an irritation, and I think that is what started the conflict between breaking and jobbing, definitely.
Do you feel it harmed the broker's business? In the sense that you didn't feel you were getting a competitive price, yes.
It harmed the broker, perhaps, because it became more expensive for the client to deal. Though, if you're dealing it for institutions, I mean, quite honestly, they should be dealing in long term, and a penny or eight, it shouldn't make much difference. It just seemed unnecessary to us brokers that a chap has to make a price, rather than if he wanted to make something different, he could.
Yes.
You know, or should be allowed to.
Yes. Did it make all that much difference in the end? As you said, you could ask the jobber to deal inside, and then, as many jobbers have said to me, while the spread was fixed, the actual price wasn't, and you could then, you know, check with all the different jobbers and theoretically get a closer price.
Yes, you could. It didn't really work like that very much. I know in theory it should, but in practice I don't think it did work.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you very often found them all making the same price. I think what you did do, you got, perhaps they made the size a little bit bigger for a while. But it's a fairly trivial thing, but it was just an irritation, and I think that, you know, as I said, is where the conflict started coming in.
Yes.
And then I think it presumably came in because the jobbers weren't making very much money, and times were difficult, which probably meant the brokers weren't making very much money, and then. With our commission going down, we were looking at fixed spreads and thinking, well, you know, the jobbers must be doing all right, or should be doing better. Then, well, you know, we've got to go single capacity because, you know, we can't exist on our commission alone. But we could if we, and we're matching most of the business anyway. You know, I think that was the way the thinking was going.
Did you? Were there firms who were known for busting spread agreements?
I think no, not as such. I mean, I think any of them would bust an agreement if they felt that there was an order and they wanted to do it.
How did you feel about joint books? Were they running into?
No, I mean, so long as you knew that it was, and which you did. Normally, no. I mean, you were meant to be told that they were joint with so-and-so. I mean, I don't think we came up against them very often. And presumably they're either joint books because they were such duff stocks nobody ever sort of dealt in them, or there happened to be a big deal had been done and a couple of them had got together to do it. On the duff stocks, I you know, just have sympathy for the jobbers on that, because I mean they weren't going to get anywhere later. And on the sort of, if it was a joint deal or something, well, fine. If it suited both of them to do it jointly, that's good.
Now, one thing I've been told jobbers didn't like was a broker dealer taking a larger order and breaking it into smaller chunks. Was that something that was also a problem, or was it only an occasional occurrence?
By that you mean that you have 100,000 shares to sell and you sell 25 to Wed and 25 to Aykroyd and there. I mean, you didn't do that more than once. and you actually probably didn't do it once, because in the bigger firms and doing the institutional business, your dealers would have told you very quickly, you know, you go to one chap and you deal penny out or